Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I don't know if I was going to be here, but I'm here. If you're new here, we're glad that you came to be with us today, and we look forward to spending some time afterward to get to know you a little better. I'm Kathy Converse. I've been here for about 30 years, and I'm a member of the program committee. Prairie is a warm and open community where all who come with open minds and kind hearts are welcome. We honor the richness which diversity brings to our fellowship. Differences in age, abilities, ethnicity, gender expression, family structure, political opinion, and theistic or non-theistic beliefs. We come here to refuel, to learn more about being in a relationship together. We learn how to listen, how to forgive, how to foster trust and compassion in one another, and how to live more socially just lives. Our Sunday services vary greatly and are led by either Prairie members or speakers from our greater community. Our opening words this morning are Juan Fry is going to share them with us.
These words are by Abigail Adams. Well, knowledge is a fine thing, and Mother Eve thought so, but she smarted so severely for hers that most of her daughters have been afraid of it since.
Patty Stockdale will do the chalice lighting.
We hallow this time together by kindling the lamp of our heritage. By Albert B. Lander.
So, today, we're very fortunate, and we have Robin Proud back with us. We're so lucky here at Prairie that we can benefit from her endless reading and her wonderful sense of humor, and also her curiosity about all the people that preceded us. She has brought to us information on so many people that I know I had never heard of, and I'm sure many of others, who were people who were exceedingly significant in a lot of the changes, particularly social justice changes that have occurred. So another factor is she has spent decades, working with the Toastmaster groups. So in addition to her reading, research, she's also a wonderful speaker to listen to. So today we have Robin Proud.
Do we think this is working now?
Yeah, I think so.
She's good.
Extra.
I was going to say, you note on here she's going to start with a reading from Good and Mad.
Okay, so make sure.
Good and Mad was written by Rebecca Traister, who was someone that you probably see on public TV or heard on the radio. And this was written in 2018, but she talks about the history of women's anger in the U.S. Women so angry at slavery and lynching that they risked their lives and reputations and pioneered new forms of public expression for women, including speeches in front of mixed gender and mixed race audiences. Women so furious at their lack of a franchise that they walked 150 miles from New York City to Albany to petition for the vote, went on hunger strikes and picketed outside the White House, so angry that they stayed angry for the decades it took to get the right to vote. It's about how young girls laboring in the Lowell Mills saw in their own situation a similar reflection of the insurgent rhetoric of the American Revolution as they staged walkouts that would become one of the first iterations of the American labor movement, and how a 23-year-old labor organizer named Clara Lemlich, who we saw in the picture book, who'd already been beaten for her participation in earlier strikes, grew impatient with all the talk from men at a meeting at Cooper Union in 1909, and stood up to call for a general strike that became the great uprising of 20,000 shirtwaist workers and resulted in new labor agreements with many factories in New York. And that's what our song refers to.
Be careful, you got your speaker cord in here.
Oh yeah, I got too many things on here.
Take your glasses off and then...
Yeah, I'm tangled up.
Yeah, there you go.
All my aids. All right. So I had two ideas, basically. As you, as Kathy mentioned, I have often talked about women from our Unitarian Universalist heritage, and many of them, we've heard the names, but we didn't know anything about them, or we never heard of them at all. Not too long ago, I gave a talk about women from the revolutionary times that I called founding mothers. We have founding fathers, and there are founding mothers. But I didn't include Abigail Adams because she is very well known. And then at the same time, I was interested in the fact that several books came out in 2018 about women's anger. This one, Good and Mad, a book called Rage Becomes Her by Soraya Chemaly, a collection of essays called Nasty Women. And these books pinpoint the emotion that fueled the Women's March of 2017 and the Me Too movement and other current phenomena. And when I talk about historical women, I always try to tie it to current issues. So I decided to focus on some parts of Abigail Adams where she spoke up and see if we can get these two subjects to go together. Abigail was born Abigail Smith in 1744. She was the daughter of a Congregational minister. She was educated at home with, and there was very little education available for girls. She later said, "It is really mortifying when a woman possessed of a common share of understanding considers the difference of education between the male and female sex, even in those families where education is attended to. Nay, why should your sex wish for such a disparity in those whom they one day intend for companions and associates? Pardon me, sir, if I cannot help sometimes suspecting that this neglect arises in some measure from an ungenerous jealousy of rivals near the throne. That is, perhaps men do not want women to get too smart because they might want to share some of their power." She was allowed to read from her father's library, which she did, and she also had a tutor named Richard Cranch. Cranch one day brought over his friend John Adams. It wasn't love at first sight, but from the beginning they admired each other's intelligence. They married when Abigail was 19 and John was 28. Their first child, Abigail, but always called Nabby, was born 9 months after the wedding. In all, Abigail was to have 6 children, of whom one was stillborn and one died before the age of 2, which was a very common ratio at the time. You probably know that John Adams spent many years away from home. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Conventions, he was a congressman, and he was a diplomat overseas. He and Abigail wrote copious letters, so this was very good for posterity because they were away and had to write so much. They're probably the most documented in history. They both wrote about philosophical and political ideas as well as their everyday family concerns. John's absences meant that Abigail managed the farm, the servants, the property, and some business ventures. She made her own decisions. In 1774, as the British military presence was ramping up around Boston, John wrote from Philadelphia, urging Abigail to move all his books and papers to their Massachusetts farm, Braintree. She wrote back, "You mentioned the removal of our books, etc., from Boston. I believe they are safe there." So she was confident in her own ability to assess the situation, and indeed there wasn't a problem. She famously asked John to send her some pins. This wasn't because she was a housewife who had to sew for her family. Seeing that this commodity was in short supply, she set up a successful business. While John was away at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, Abigail at home in Massachusetts was at ground zero for the lead-up and start of the Revolution. She took her 7-year-old son, John Quincy, to watch from a distance the Battle of Bunker Hill. She was 100% for the Revolution. In her famous letter of 1776, she wrote to John, "I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless, to use us with cruelty and indignity. All men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. It's hard to tell how much of Abigail's letter was intended to be humorous with its reflection of the grievances of the colonies and the representation issue. Her husband took it that way. Humorously, he jokingly compared her rebellion with unsettled behavior among various populations, and he claimed that women really ruled the roost. Our masculine systems are little more than theory. We dare not exert our power in its full latitude. We are obliged to go fair and softly. To repeal our masculine systems would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat. Overall, his reply was, "I cannot but laugh." Both Adamses had their eye on the future of the Republic, and they knew themselves and their offspring as models. When John asserted the importance of statesmen and philosophers in the new American system, Abigail reminded him that mothers were the first educators. "If we mean to have heroes, statesmen, and philosophers," she wrote, "we should have learned women." In 1778, Abigail received from her cousin John Thaxter a newspaper account of a statue erected in London. Reverend Thomas Wilson had placed a statue of the English historian Catherine Macaulay in his church. He called her a prodigy. The inscription said, "Once in every age, I could wish such a woman to appear as proof that genius is not confined to sex." Abigail replied that Reverend Wilson has sullied the glory of his deed by the narrow, contracted spirit which he discovers in his inscription. How he could wish that but one woman in an age might excel, because he said there should be one woman like this in every age. How he could wish that but one woman in an age might excel, and she only for the sake of a prodigy, that is, an exception. She would be the one woman. What must be that genius which cannot do justice to one lady, but at the expense of the whole sex? And in the same letter she wrote on education, "Every assistance and advantage which can be procured is afforded to the sons, whilst the daughters are totally neglected. Why should children of the same parents be thus distinguished? It is really mortifying." This letter happened to be written a day after a momentous event in Abigail's life. In February 1778, when the outcome of the revolution was highly in doubt, John Adams and his 10-year-old son, John Quincy, sailed for France. John's assignment was to seek help from the French for the colonists. Abigail wanted to go, but the danger of a possible pregnancy and childbirth was real. This was their first lengthy separation without regular mail. When John was in Boston, New York, or Philadelphia, they could write regularly. Now everything had to go by sea, and this was a time when the British were seizing and sinking ships. And even if the mail worked, it would be a very long time before you got a response. So with this distance and delay, Abigail often had to make decisions about the farm and family without John's input. The travelers returned to Boston eventually, but within a year, John set sail again, this time with two sons. He was sent to negotiate the peace treaty with England and to obtain a loan from the Netherlands. Back home, Abigail continued to speculate on the place of women in the new republic. She deplored the fact that half of the population was, she said, deprived of a voice in legislation and obliged to submit to those laws which are imposed upon us. Excluded from honors and from offices, we cannot attach ourselves to the state or government from having held a place of eminence. This quotation is less known, but I think it's more radical than "Remember the Ladies." She seems to be asking not just for consideration, but criticizing a flaw in the new democracy and saying, "I think that women should be part of the government." And this time it was 5 years before Abigail saw her husband and those two sons again. She was able to join them finally. The family was in Paris for a while, and then John was named minister to England, and they were in London. Finally, when they returned to Massachusetts, Washington was chosen as the first president, with Adams as vice president. The capital at the time was still in Philadelphia. Although Abigail at first lived there with John, the expense of their travels and entertaining led her to return to the farm, So again, she was running various enterprises while he was off in politics. Now, George and Martha Washington, of course, were the first couple, but this was sort of an afterthought. George was a military man. Martha had already been a wealthy widow when she married him. But John and Abigail had spent their lives preparing for citizenship and leadership in this new country. Now, I'm going to skip over a few things. For instance, Abigail was not at all progressive on the view on immigration. She backed her husband on the Alien and Sedition Acts, which did things like lock up people who dared to criticize the president. But so when Washington declined to run again after two terms, it was clear that John Adams was the Federalist candidate, while the Republicans nominated his former friend and now rival, Thomas Jefferson. Abigail, of course, wanted her husband to be given his due. He had prepared his whole life for this. But she also feared the public nature of her role. She said she would have to look at every word before I utter it and to impose a silence on myself when I long to talk. By the rules of the time, the first place finisher, John Adams, became president, with his rival Jefferson as vice president. You can imagine how well that worked. Or you can see Hamilton, which covers that too. So it was both a blow and a relief that Adams didn't have enough support for a second term. About Abigail's later years, Woody Holton, in his biography, writes, "Abigail Adams' biographers sometimes claim that she mellowed during her final years. It is a beguiling image, but it is a myth. The truth is that in old age, Adams tried harder than ever to manage the world around her. Her incontrollable attachment to the superintendence of every part of her household, as her husband said, worried him, so she was a micromanager. John ought to have realized," she said, "that domestic..." Biographer says, "John ought to have realized that domestic labors that exhausted her body refreshed her mind." And she wrote to her sister in 1811, "I am really so self-sufficient as to believe that I can do it better than any of my family." What a shame it would have been if Abigail had lived all her life under the thumb of a father and husband who kept her only to look pretty, bear children, and supervise a few servants. She might have succumbed to depression and bitterness like Julia Ward Howe, who's another person I spoke about. Instead, John continued to discuss issues with his wife and to ask her to review his letters before he sent them. And in her late years, she wrote some things about how she supported the new pastor, William Ellery Channing, who was one of our founders of Unitarianism. Abigail died in 1818 at the age of 73, 3 days after her 54th wedding anniversary. This was 7 years before her son John Quincy was to become president, and 8 years before John Adams was to die on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and also the death date of his friend and enemy, Thomas Jefferson. At her death, Abigail did something striking. She wrote the following: "I, Abigail Adams, wife to the Honorable John Adams of Quincy in the county of Norfolk, by and with his consent, do dispose of the following property." By law at the time, there was no need for this, as the husband automatically owned all the property of the marriage. Although she mentions her husband's consent, the idea that she had a choice in her bequests was radical, but it was only fitting, since she had spent her life creating and managing the family legacy, both economic and political. This is a really short précis of Abigail, and I'm going to add something else about today. One book that's written about her, which won a prize, Abigail Adams by Woody Holton, and there's a kind of a degrees of separation thing here. Woody Holton is a historian. He has a sister named Ann Holton. Ann Holton is married to Tim Kaine, who was the running mate for Hillary Clinton, who, of course, was our first woman major candidate for president and mother of Chelsea, who wrote that book. So to bring us to today, women's power really showed up at the Women's March, but many of the mainstream political and media figures downplay this. This was a one-day thing for women to go out and have a good time. Rebecca Traister said, "To anyone who actually attended the event, the proposition that it was some casually undertaken dilettante party about hats was nuts. The day before the march, I'd been part of a panel about women's resistance at the Washington, D.C. bookstore, where so many people showed up that they had to bar the door. Inside, the conversation had been urgent, tactical, about candidates and which organizations were doing voter registration and fighting gerrymandering. As soon as the march had concluded, its organizers had staged a gathering called Where Do We Go From Here? One story that I love is that there was a local representative of some kind, a councilman or state representative, who tweeted, "I hope the ladies are home in time to make dinner." One woman who was his constituent was so annoyed by this, she ran against him that year and won his seat. Abigail would have enjoyed that. And then in October 2017, the New York Times and the New Yorker published very long stories about Harvey Weinstein. And this led to many more stories about men's and women's power in many industries. What happened in the second decade of the 21st century is that women began to rage publicly in ways that made them audible to one another. And as far as the Me Too movement, Rebecca Traister was often interviewed about this. She said, "Frequently in those months, I was asked about how to address men's confusion and discomfort. How were they supposed to flirt? What if their respectful and professional gestures of affiliation had been misunderstood? Mothers told me of sons worried about being misinterpreted, that they would face unjust consequences that would damage their prospects. The amazing thing was the lack of acknowledgement that these anxieties are the normal state for just about everyone who is not a white man, that black mothers reasonably worry every day that a toy or a phone or a pack of Skittles might be seen as a gun, that their child's very presence might be understood as a threat, and the repercussions might extend far beyond a dismissal from a job, and might result in arrest, imprisonment, or execution. Women enter young adulthood constantly aware that their inebriation might be taken for consent, or their consent for sluttiness, or that any understanding of them having been drunk or slutty might one day undercut any claim they might make about having been violently aggressed upon. Women enter the workforce understanding from the start the need to work around and accommodate the leering advances and bad jokes of their colleagues, aware that the wrong response might change the course of their professional lives." Rose McGowan, one of Weinstein's earliest and most vociferous accusers, recalled being asked, as she said, in a soft NPR voice, "What if what you're saying makes men uncomfortable?" She answered, "Good. I've been uncomfortable my whole life. Welcome to our world of discomfort." On the political side, in 2018, all previous records were being broken. 309 women by the spring had announced they were running for seats in the House of Representatives, higher than any other time in American history, and nearly twice the number that had run 2 years before. 47 black women were running for federal seats in total. At least 24 of them non-incumbent black women running for the House of Representatives, then home to only 20 black women. And on the individual basis, many women who had never been involved in politics or communities before got involved. Now, most of the people here have been involved for a long time in local community organizations of various kinds, but for many women, this was a totally new thing. And some of them found that they found their people this way. A woman said, "It was the first time since the election that I felt empowered. There's a whole lot of people like me. My favorite slogan," one of them said, "is you are not alone." Woman after woman spoke of how the loud eruption of their rage had brought them into a community they never knew existed. And toward the end here, Rebecca Traister talks about how writing this book about anger, she was concerned would be very detrimental to her mental health. Of course, everyone knows it's not good for us to be angry, right? But that wasn't how she felt. She said there was something about spending my days and nights immersed in anger, mine and the anger of others, that had been undeniably good for me. It seemed to fly in the face of everything I had ever been taught. And then she said, "Oh yes, I no longer believe that it was harmful. I returned again and again to a proclamation made by Elizabeth Cady Stanton nearly two centuries earlier that if women would indulge more freely in vituperation, they would enjoy 10 times the health they do. It seems to me they are suffering from repression. And another wonderful angry woman, Molly Ivins, called this sustained outrage. Right now at the Market Square Theater for $3, you can see this wonderful film about her. I think it's called Raise Hell, The Life of Molly Ivins. And one of her last columns before she died of cancer, she talked about how much she enjoyed the fight. Rebecca Tracer says, having had the rare and privileged experience of having had my anger taken seriously, I no longer believe that it's anger that is hurting us, but rather the system that penalizes us for expressing it. And this could certainly be true of the Black community and many other communities. The system doesn't respect or hear it, mocks or ignores it. That's what's making us sick. Consider that white men in the Rust Belt are rarely told that their anger is bad for them. Rather, and correctly, we understand that what's bad for them are the conditions that provoke their frustration. And in the very end, she says, this particular moment will pass in some way, and you might be tempted then to retreat to a more peaceful life. But I say to all the women reading this now and to my future self, what you're angry about now, injustice, will still exist, even if you yourself are not experiencing it or are tempted to stop thinking about how you experience it and how you contribute to it. Others are still experiencing it and still mad. Some of them are mad at you. Don't forget them. Don't write off their anger. Stay mad for them. Stay mad with them. They are right to be mad, and you're right to be mad alongside them. Being mad is correct. Being mad is American. Being mad can be joyful and productive and connective. Don't ever let them talk you out of being mad again. So I'd be happy to hear some comments or questions. And then you'll have to see there's a little message hidden in the background of this book that you can look at. Well, that is a good point, because anger is used for things that we might not consider, for purposes we might not agree with. So this was a group that would show up at funerals of service people, right? And with hateful messages about homosexuality and other...
Well, I'm pretty...
Evelyn will read our closing words.
Arbitrary power is, like most other things which are very hard, very liable to be broken.
That was Abigail Adams also. Thank you for coming. Greet your neighbors.